It is a great pleasure to call our brother Jim Carrey to address us to the title Jehoshaphat, Judah's Great Teacher. Brother Jim.
Thanks, Brother Eric. Dear brothers and sisters and young people, we have before us this evening one of Judah's finest rulers. No man did more to educate the ecclesia of God than did Jehoshaphat. And that's why we've called him Judah's Great Teacher. And yet, paradoxically, very few men did more to bring the ecclesia to the brink of ruin than did Jehoshaphat. And we will see how that unfolds as we proceed this evening. It's a great paradox. And as we have said before of this man elsewhere, he is one of the greatest enigmas in the whole of the Scriptures. And yet I believe, brothers and sisters and young people, that we have set before us one of our most salutary lessons that we can possibly be given this side of the kingdom of God. And I mean that. The lesson of this man's life is so important for this generation of Christadelphians that we must sit up and take notice of it. You know, Jehoshaphat's life falls into two distinct phases, and they are clearly set forth in the 17th and the 18th chapters of this second book of Chronicles. The theme of chapter 17 is one of ascension. Jehoshaphat goes up, and he fulfills his name, brethren and sisters and young people, which means Yahweh is judge, or in a paraphrase, because the word judge can mean to vindicate, Yahweh is vindicated. And indeed he was vindicated in the reign of this man. And in chapter 17 we see divine blessings poured upon Jehoshaphat because of a sound policy. Yahweh blessed his policy. He gave him strength. He gave him riches and honor in abundance as a result of that strength. But, tragically, the 18th chapter of the second book of Chronicles sets forth Jehoshaphat's decline. And the theme of that chapter is declension, where Yahweh's purpose is frustrated. It is frustrated by compromise. And we get to see those two phases set forth, the sad mixture in the life of this man of triumph and tragedy. And we're going to see what it brought Judah to, almost the point of utter ruin. We're going to see the causes for that, and I hope that we shall learn the lessons that are set forth for us. This man's life's work was destroyed. His family was ruined. And the promises that God made to David were brought to within a hair's breadth of total collapse because of a change in his policy. You know, at 10 years of age, we are very impressionable. But at 10 years of age, we cannot understand policy. And when Asa was conducting that greatest of all special efforts in the history of either Israel or Judah, young Prince Jehoshaphat was 10 years of age. I want you to join me in the 15th chapter of the second of Chronicles to have a look again at this great special effort. And as Asa gathered the people of Judah and the sojourners from the northern kingdom of Israel, we read in the 8th verse that having heard the words of the prophecy of Azariah the son of Oded, he took courage and put away the abominable idols out of the land of Judah and Benjamin, and so on, and renewed the altar of Yahweh that was before the porch of Yahweh, and he gathered all Judah and Benjamin and the strangers with them out of Ephraim and Manasseh and out of Simeon, for they fought him out of Israel in abundance when they saw that Yahweh his God was with him. So they gathered themselves together, and then they had, brothers and sisters, as you will recall, that great rededication to seek Yahweh with all their heart, and they did that, and they found him. Judah never reached greater heights than that. And while that was going on, brethren and sisters, there was a 10-year-old boy standing beside his father, observing that dedication, observing the way it affected the hearts and the minds of the brethren and sisters, seeing how the word of God took hold of them and how it drove them to seek Yahweh with all their heart. And young children are impressionable, aren't they? They are impressed by the dedication of their parents to the truth, and they want to be like that themselves. And there's no question whatsoever that Jehoshaphat was a product of his upbringing. He was a young boy who grew up in that environment. That was the atmosphere of ecclesial life as he grew up. And there was positive dedication. And when he came to the age of maturity, he could handle the fact that his father had begun to sit back. He could handle the fact at the end of his father's life that his father Asa had gone off the rails through self-reliance. But he was determined not to do the same. And that's the story of the 17th chapter. And when you come to verse 1 of chapter 17, Jehoshaphat his son reigned in his stead and strengthened himself against Israel. Now why does it say that? Well, it says it because of the first verse of the previous chapter, which brought about the demise of King Asa. For Baasha, king of Israel, came down and locked off the border. He stopped the migration of his subjects into Judah. Asa couldn't face that, and he went to Syria, made a covenant. He was rebuked by a prophet. He bound the prophet, and was bound himself in his feet, and died in that state. Jehoshaphat wasn't going to make that mistake. And so he strengthened himself against Israel, but there was another reason why he strengthened himself against Israel, and that becomes obvious as you move on. But before we move on, take a note of the fact that that word against there doesn't simply mean against. It is the Hebrew word al, A-L. We hear about LL airlines. Well, al is the Hebrew word for above, or upon, or over. And it comes from the root word Allah, meaning to ascend, to be high, to mount. And so here the policy of Jehoshaphat is set forth. He determined in his heart, brethren, sisters and young people, to rise above Israel. And that's always the way to overcome any problem in life. To rise above it. Sublimation is always better than repression. And he understood the need to rise above Israel and to strengthen himself and his ecclesia, that they might not be given problems by Israel as Asa had been. And so verse 2 we read, and he placed forces in all the fenced cities of Judah and set garrisons in the land of Judah and in the cities of Ephraim which Asa his father had taken, and Yahweh was with Jehoshaphat. So God was blessing his policy, because it then says he walked in the first ways of his father. And the margin is right, and of David. The first ways of Asa were of course very good in the sight of Yahweh, and he blessed Asa for it. It was in his latter days that he failed. And so Jehoshaphat took up the first ways of his father Asa and the ways of David, and he sought not unto Balaam. Now why on earth are those words at the end of verse 3? Have you ever thought about it? Is it ever suggested that Asa sought unto Balaam? He didn't. David, of course, didn't. Why put those words there? Well, you see, brothers and sisters and young people, when Jehoshaphat came to the throne of Judah, there had been a man reigning upon the throne of Israel in the north for 3 years, who had by this time taken to himself a Zidonian for a wife, and introduced into Israel the vile worship of Baal. His name was Ahab. And Jehoshaphat knew what was going on in the northern kingdom. He knew what Ahab was doing. He knew that Baal worship had become entrenched in Israel through the machinations of Ahab and Jezebel, combining together to educate the ecclesia of Israel in the abhorrent practices associated with Baal worship. And so verse 3 is telling us that Jehoshaphat's policy was blessed by Yahweh because he was doing the opposite to what Ahab and Jezebel were doing. And if you don't think that's the right interpretation, we'll then read on, verse 4. But sought to Yahweh, God of his father, and walked in his commandments, and not after the doings of Israel. And in my Bible, I have a line drawn between the end of verse 3 and the end of verse 4. Because that's exactly what they were doing in Israel. They were seeking unto Balaam, lords many and gods many, the God of the flesh, chief among them all. But look at verse 5. Because he was doing this, because he was rising above Israel and refusing to go in their direction, Yahweh established his kingdom. Yahweh builds the house, brothers and sisters. Jehoshaphat was guiding it in the way that he thought he must, but it was Yahweh who established it in his hand. And all Judah brought to Jehoshaphat presents, and he had riches and honor in abundance. That's the other way around from what you would normally expect. Subjects normally expect to be given something by their rulers. The subjects of Judah realized the value of Jehoshaphat's leadership, and they paid their respect to him, and they brought the acknowledgement that he was going in the right way. And so we read that he had riches and honor in abundance, and his heart, verse 6, was lifted up in the ways of Yahweh. The word lifted up there in the Hebrew is gabar. And gabar means to soar, to be lofty. It has the idea of flying high, soaring away. And here was this man's heart, soaring in the things of the truth. He was rising above his brothers and sisters. And Yahweh was blessing him in that policy. And then it says, at the end of verse 6, that he took away the high places and the groves out of Judah. On the principle of Hebrews 1, verse 9, he loved righteousness, and as a consequence of it, he hated iniquity. It was because, brethren and sisters, his heart soared in the things of the truth that he detested idolatry. And that's the rule of thumb of the true Christadelphian. It's not a matter of legislation. It's a matter of having your heart rise to great heights in the things of the truth, so that you cannot stand or tolerate the things upon which Yahweh looks with abhorrence. And so here we have, in the first few verses of chapter 17, plainly set forth a clear direction, a policy, and that policy was to strengthen himself against the evils that were taking place in Israel. But we need to pause for a moment. We need to reflect, brethren and sisters, upon one thing. Though Ahab was the worst king of Israel, and though his wife was a Zidonian, Israel remained, as we said on Saturday evening, the ecclesia of God. And there was in that nation a covenant family, 7,000 of them, who had not bowed the knee to Baal in the days when Elijah came along. Prophets were sent to them. And amongst those prophets were Elijah himself, Elisha his successor, Micaiah, whom we shall meet this evening, and they went to upbraid the rulers of Israel and to try and turn them back. And so we reject out of hand any suggestion that Israel at this stage of their history were a type of the Catholic Church and not of the Ecclesia. Does Yahweh have a covenant family in the Catholic Church? Of course he doesn't. Does he send prophets to them? Of course he doesn't. And so clearly, we have before us a record that is very pertinent to ecclesial life today. And we need to recognize that. You know what was happening in the northern kingdom of Israel? As Jehoshaphat in verse 7 began his campaign of education? Well, I'll show you in a moment by going back to the reference we looked at on Saturday evening. In verse 7 we read, also in the third year of his reign, he sent to his princes, even to Ben-Hail and Obadiah, Zechariah, and so on, to teach in the cities of Judah. The word teach there is lamed, and it means to goad. To use a goad. To impel by education. And so he sent forth his princes to teach in the cities of Judah. He begins an all-pervasive, all-embracing campaign of education in the ecclesia of God. He tries to reach every member of that ecclesia. And it says in the ninth verse, having listed off for us the Levites and the priests who went forth, that they taught in Judah and had the book of the law of Yahweh with them. They took the Bible with them, and they went about throughout all the cities of Judah and taught the people. So here was a campaign of education. Now you come with me to Revelation chapter 2, and we'll see what was happening in the north. We're not told that in the record of Chronicles, but we are told it in Revelation 2 and verse 20. Remember, the Lord wrote to Thyatira in the 18th verse and commends them for their works, love, service, faith, patience, and works again in verse 19. Yes, there was a covenant family in Thyatira. There were people there who were serving him in purity, but they tolerated in their midst the Jezebel class, verse 20. Notwithstanding, I have against thee something very serious, because you permit, as the word sufferous means, you permit or you let that woman Jezebel, which calls herself a teacher, as the word prophetess means, to teach and to seduce my servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols. And so what was going on in Thyatira is that a group of people called a Jezebel class were teaching and seducing the members of that ecclesia who had been, and many of them still were, basically sound and dedicated. They were teaching them to break down the standards and to commit spiritual fornication. Jezebel didn't have it all her own way. She didn't have it all her own way in Israel either for quite some time. And so you see, we've got to bear this in mind. Jehoshaphat was dealing with a kingdom in the north that wasn't all bad. There was a lot of good in it. And Yahweh knew that, and yet he blessed his policy of strengthening himself against Israel. I want to say something more about Jezebel here in Revelation 2. What do we regard as the more serious crime in the divine sight, brothers and sisters? The literal fornication which Jezebel taught, which was part and parcel of Baal worship, or spiritual fornication, about which the Lord Jesus Christ is talking here? I'll give you a test. You can test yourself. What does Yahweh consider to be worse? A brother found consorting with a harlot? Literal fornication? As many did in Israel of old with Jezebel and her type? Or a Christadelphian ecclesia inviting a clergyman to speak from their platform? Well, you see, if we were honest with ourselves, we find it more abhorrent to consider the former. And we take, rightly so, firm action against brethren, if there should be any, found committing fornication. But you know, we betray ourselves, don't we? At least I've betrayed myself. For when it was brought to my attention, just a couple of years ago, that an ecclesia just a stone's throw away from my home ecclesia in Brisbane had conducted a seminar which was held in three halls, one of which was a Christadelphian ecclesial hall, which they call a church, and the other two actual churches, and that the speakers were on a rotational basis, one Christadelphian and two clergymen. I laughed it off and said, well, you'd expect that, wouldn't you? I betrayed, brethren and sisters, myself. Because, you see, had we had a case of a brother consorting with a harlot, we would have been very firm. We would have taken action. But we didn't get upset that much about that sort of thing going on. We simply laughed it off. Mind you, we're concerned about it, but we did nothing about it. Yahweh treats spiritual fornication a lot more seriously than what you and I do. And spiritual fornication is breaking down the standards, bringing the world into the ecclesia, or taking members of the ecclesia into the world and consorting with them in both their immoral practices and chiefly with their religious views, doctrines and practices. That is adultery in divine sight. And it's happening all over the place today in Christadelphia. Now you come back with me to the 17th chapter of the 2nd of Chronicles, chapter 17. Here in this book, which presents to us this tragic figure, Jehoshaphat. Because he understood exactly what I've just said. He understood that in the early part of his life, and he abandoned it at the end of his life and lost everything. And so in the 7th verse, as we read, in his 3rd year, he set about this task of educating the ecclesia of God. Ahab had been there doing it for 6 years by now. And who does he send for? Well, he sends for 5 princes, 9 Levites, and 2 priests. Now, I won't go through their names. It's very interesting to do that. They are all basically Yahwistic names. That is, the divine names, name or titles, are used as part of the name. For instance, Ben-Hail, son of Might, Obadiah, serving Yahweh, Zechariah, Yah has remembered, and so on. There is something to do with the divine name or titles involved in the names of these men. But that's not the point I want to make about it. There are 5 princes. 5 is the number of grace or mercy. There are 9 Levites. 9 is the number of judgment or justice. Mercy and truth. And there are 2 priests, and 2 is the number of division or separation. So while Jezebel in the north was teaching God's servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols, Jehoshaphat was teaching his ecclesia God manifestation. The manifestation of God's mercy and his truth, which will separate you from the things of the world. And of course, separation is the very substratum of God manifestation. You cannot have a manifestation of God where there is none. 5 princes, 9 Levites, and 2 priests. Amazing, isn't it? But there in those numbers alone, we have some indication of what they were teaching in that nation. And so they go forth, carrying the book of the law. And look at the result, verse 10. The fear of Yahweh fell upon all the kingdoms of the lands that were round about Judah, so that they made no war against Jehoshaphat. God gave them the opportunities to teach. He gave them peace, so that the job could be done. And it was done on the principle of Proverbs 16, verse 7. When a man's ways please Yahweh, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. And in that time, Jehoshaphat diligently applied himself. And we read in the 11th verse that the Philistines and the Arabians and others gave him enormous quantities of animals, which of course he would use probably in the sacrifices. And so in the 12th verse, Jehoshaphat waxed great exceedingly, and he built in Judah castles and cities of store. Now there's a phrase in verse 12 that needs some examination. It's the phrase waxed great exceedingly, because again it is hammering home the theme of this chapter, to ascend, to rise up, to soar. The word waxed means really to walk. It's the Hebrew halak. The word great means great or large, while the word exceedingly is mael, M-A-A-L. And it is, of course, a composition, which includes that word al that we met back there in verse 1. Remember, the word against was al. Mael means upward, or above, or overhead. So here we have a phrase that tells us the direction of Jehoshaphat. This was the way he was going, brothers and sisters, and this is the way you and I ought to go. We ought to be walking greatly upwards toward our God. And that was the way he was going. And we read that he built in Judah castles and cities of store, and he had much business in the cities of Judah. And the men of war, mighty men of valor, were in Jerusalem, and there were a lot of them. This is the list of them in verses 14 to 18. And these are the numbers of them according to the house of their fathers. Of Judah, the captains of thousands, Adna, the chief. His name means pleasure. It was a pleasure to serve under him, because he was a man who was chosen for his righteousness. How do we know that? Well, look at his deputies. And with him, mighty men of valor, 300,000. And next to him was Jehohanan, the captain. And with him, 280,000. Jehohanan means Yahweh favored. And he favored him with responsibility. He gave him 280,000 men to look after, all warriors of the faith. Verse 16, and next him was Amasiah. His name means Yah has loaded. Why did Yahweh load this man with responsibility? Well, he was the son of Zichri, and Zichri means memorable. And that was a memorable family. In fact, if you make a note of 2 Chronicles 23 and verse 1, you'll find mention of another son of Zichri, another faithful man. But this fellow here, Amasiah, is said to have willingly offered himself to Yahweh. And that's the only record you'll find of Amasiah in the whole of the Bible, brothers and sisters. But if only you and I could have that summary placed at the base of the record of our lives, wouldn't it be tremendous? If nothing else was said about me at the judgment seat of Christ, then that phrase, I would be perfectly happy. Here was a man whom Yahweh loaded with responsibility. He came from a memorable family, and he willingly offered himself unto Yahweh. The word willingly offered is nadab in the Hebrew, and it means to impel, and hence to volunteer spontaneously. He volunteered his services spontaneously in the truth. He didn't need to bulldoze him to do anything. He did it because he wanted to do it. And the word, of course, offered is zabak. Nadab, zabak is the literal Hebrew. He spontaneously offered himself. And that word zabak is used of slaughtering the sacrifices under the law. And Paul tells us in Romans 12 verse 1 that we ought, brethren and sisters and young people, to offer ourselves as living sacrifices, and uses a word that means to slaughter. Living sacrifices. Here is one in the Old Testament. And unto him were given 200,000 mighty men of valor. And of Benjamin, verse 17, there was Eliada. His name means God is knowing. He was a mighty man of valor. And with him were armed men with bow and shield, 200,000. And next to him was Jehozabad, Yahweh endowed. He had endowments that came as a result of blessings in the truth. And he was given 180,000. And they were already prepared for war? No. Read it again. They were ready, prepared for the war. What war? Well, I'll tell you what war it wasn't. They were not prepared for the war which they fought. The war at the end of verse 3 of the next chapter. The war against the Syrians in alliance with Ahab. That was not the war for which they had been prepared. But tragically it was the war they fought, and it was a disaster. And in the 19th verse we read, these waited on the king beside those whom the king put in the fenced cities throughout all Judah. Now those of you who are good at mathematics will have by this time added up the figures there, and you will know that there was 1,160,000 men in Jehoshaphat's army. And you'll also have noticed that that was not all, because it says these waited on the king. They were in Jerusalem or around Jerusalem beside those who were in the fenced cities of Judah. How many were out there? We don't know. So Jehoshaphat had a massive army. And this was the result, brothers and sisters, of his policy and of his campaign of education. He brought about a cohesive, united ecclesia who were prepared to stand for what was right. They were ready, prepared for the war. The war against the encroachments of the world. Wherever it might have come from, they were ready for it. But they never fought that war. because Jehoshaphat changed his policy. So the 17th chapter talks about him rising up and soaring and walking greatly upwards, and there's the result of it. The 18th chapter talks about him going down, verse 2, and after certain years he went down. Amazing, isn't it? Why did it happen? Well, it happened, brothers and sisters, because of verse 1 of chapter 18. Now Jehoshaphat had riches and honour in abundance and joined affinity with Ahab. But let's explain the motivation as to why he would join affinity, and then we'll talk about what that meant. He had riches and honour in abundance. That was the source of his problem. It bred in him, for the opposite reason that it had bred the same thing in Asa, the spirit of self-reliance. Whereas Asa's problem came about as a result of weakness and ill-preparedness to face the threat of Baasha, Jehoshaphat's self-reliance sprang out of his strength. Now you know what? I've heard a Gentile commentator about this particular passage who said that it was necessary for Jehoshaphat to make an alliance with Ahab because Jehoshaphat at the time was very weak. Have you ever heard such nonsense? That is the absolute opposite to the truth. He was so strong, he didn't know what to do with his army. He had 1,160,000 of them around Jerusalem. He was strong, brothers and sisters, there's no question about that. And it was because he was strong that he changed his policy. And instead of strengthening himself against Israel, he decided to save them by his strength. And that's what it means when it says he had riches and honour in abundance. Riches, of course, in his case, meant the wealth that came to him from the gifts that were offered both by his people and by the nations around. It poured in to Judah. And so he accumulated an enormous stack of wealth. But when you talk about that in our terms, as to what it might mean for us, it means this, brethren and sisters, he was richly blessed in the things of the truth. That's what it means in spiritual terms. Those blessings were given to him by God. That chapter we've just read tells us that. They were the results of divine blessing. So to us that means this. But if we press on in the truth and soar high in the things of the word and go about the task of educating every member of the ecclesia and causing them to walk as manifestations of deity himself, we will be blessed. We'll be blessed with successive generations of Christadelphians who will hold fast to the truth. And that was the state in which Jehoshaphat found himself. And it brought about an enormous reputation. He was known to be strong in the truth. He was known to have an army that was so great. And he thought, brethren and sisters, that his strength was sufficient to save Israel from their apostate direction. He thought that he could do something to arrest the decline that he witnessed in the north. And so he decides to make an alliance. How does he do it? Well, he joined affinity. And the word joined affinity in the Hebrew is chafen. It is spelled, for those of you who want to take it down, C-H-A-T-H-A-N. Chafen. And it means, and it's a very interesting word, to give away in marriage. Normally a daughter. In this case, it was a son that he gave away in marriage. Hence, it means to contract affinity by marriage. And it was, of course, the practice of those times that when kings made an alliance of a political nature, they would cement that alliance by marrying into each other's families. In this case, brothers and sisters, Jehoshaphat took for his eldest son Jehoram Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel. You know what? Jehoram's name means Yahweh raised. That was the subject matter of chapter 17. Athaliah's name means Yah hath constrained. That's the subject of chapter 18. Do I say chapter 18 twice? I can't remember. Chapter 17, of course, is the rising up. Chapter 18 is Jehoshaphat being constrained, brought down. So there you have, in the names of the two individuals who were married, a clear setting forth of the two policies and the results of those policies. But I want you just to pause and to consider for a moment the character of this Christadelphian wedding. What a wedding it would have been. You know, all we're told here in one Hebrew word is that they had a wedding to cement a political alliance. But no wedding goes off with the passing of one word. I know a little bit about that, and so do you. If you're involved in organising weddings, you will know that there is a plethora of things that need to be attended to. There is a mountain of details that need to be overcome. And those details would have been addressed by the participants in this wedding. And can you imagine how that process would have unfolded? Well, you think about it. This was a Christadelphian wedding. And as they began to work out the details, and I'll put it in our modern language so you can see something of what might have occurred. In our times, of course, it is the parents of the bride who arrange the wedding. But I'm quite sure that Jehoshaphat would have liked to have had a say in what went on. And as they sat down to organise the details, you can be absolutely certain that Jezebel would want to have invited her Zidonian relatives, who were haters of the things of Yahweh. You can be absolutely certain that she would have wanted to have the tables filled with all sorts of liquor and spirits. Jehoshaphat and his wife would have been quite satisfied with punch or with perhaps apple cider. You can imagine, can't you, that Jezebel and Ahab would have demanded that they dance at that wedding? And Jehoshaphat would have been quite prepared to have someone give a talk from the Bible. You can also imagine, can't you, brothers and sisters, that on every single detail that had some relationship to the truth, they would have been miles apart. But he went through with it. And can you imagine the wedding photograph? Because it didn't have cameras in those days, they might have had an artist. Can you imagine the wedding photograph? As that bridal couple stood there, Athaliah, the young girl, clinging onto the arm of Jehoram, the firstborn of Jehoshaphat, with the respective parents on either side, can you imagine the look on the face of Jezebel, grinning like a Cheshire cat? But at last she'd got her claws into this great King Jehoshaphat, and she was not going to let him go. Can you imagine it? He went through with it. He made his concessions. He swallowed his better judgment and said, well, I don't like it, but I'm going to save him anyway. I'll go part of the way, they'll come the other. And after certain years, verse 2, he went down. Doesn't take long. He went down to Ahab, to Samaria. It's almost like a man walking down steps, isn't it? He went from Jerusalem down to Ahab to Samaria. But of course Ahab was in Samaria. But it's almost like going down steps. And the record presents it that way to see that he's now in decline. And then look at what happens. Ahab killed sheep and oxen for him in abundance, and for the people that he had with him. So Jehoshaphat went down and he took a whole horde of the people of Judah with him, and they went down to Samaria. And instead of Ahab making offerings to Yahweh, of course he couldn't do that because he didn't worship Yahweh, he didn't make them to Baal either, he made offerings for Jehoshaphat. You read that in your Bible? Ahab killed sheep and oxen for him in abundance. Which means in my language this, that when they saw him coming, they knew they had him, and they knew they had to keep him. How are you going to keep him? Well, mate, when he came in, they sacrificed for him and started to pat him on the back and say, "You know, Jehoshaphat, you are a wonderful brother. We've heard about what you've done in Judah. It's exactly what we need here. We need your strength. We need your dedication. We need what you've got. Come in here." And they poured it on thick. They made sacrifices for him. And he was sucked in. Because the record says that Ahab persuaded him to go up to Ramoth Gilead. Now, I think we've got time to go back to the 1st of Kings, chapter 21. I'd like you to keep your finger in the 18th chapter of 2 Chronicles, if you would. And in your third hand, you might like to put a pencil, if you have one, because here is something I do want you to take a note of, if you haven't got it already, and I'm sure that some of you will have this. In the 1st of Kings, chapter 21, we have the record of the slaughter of Naboth and his sons by the evil designs of Jezebel. And the divine summary of what happened in that chapter, and how it was that Ahab was moved to such horror, is given to us in this 25th verse. 1 Kings 21 and verse 25. "But there was none like unto Ahab, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of Yahweh, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up." Now the word "stirred" there is the Hebrew word "soup." You spell it C-U-W-T-H. You only find that word a half a dozen times or so in the Old Testament. It's not a common word by any means. It is a word that means to prick or to stimulate. It comes, in fact, from the root word for briars and thorns that you find back in the book of Judges, etc. "They shall be briars and thorns in your side." Speaking, obviously, of Jezebel as a Canaanite, for she was indeed a Zidonian. So here we have Ahab, who was stirred up, he was pricked, he was stimulated, he was incited to evil by his wife, and she was always saying, "Why don't you do that? Why don't you do that? It'd be good to do this, wouldn't it? Come on, do that. Do that." He couldn't sleep for a minute. "Do this, do that." And she was always pricking him towards evil. You know what, brothers and sisters? The word "persuaded" in 2 Chronicles 18 verse 2 is the same word. And that's the policy that Ahab applied to Jehoshaphat. What Jezebel did to him, he proceeded to do to poor old Jehoshaphat, who had just been showered with the accolades of sacrifices, which blinded his eyes and made him think that he indeed was strong. You know what? What he achieved was an identification with Ahab that brought Jehoshaphat to obliteration. And I shall proceed to show that that's exactly what happened. The fact that Ahab killed sheep and oxen may illustrate that he considered himself to be the high priest of his sister. Bear in mind, brothers and sisters, that he then says, persuading him to go up to Ramoth Gilead, he says, "I want you, Jehoshaphat, to come with me to a city of refuge." Ahab would not have recognized Ramoth Gilead as such, but it was. We've just had a look at a chapter which speaks about the way in which Ahab murdered Naboth. Get the drift of what I'm saying? You've got a high priest who is a murderer, and they are going to a city of refuge to take it back from the hands of the Syrians. I'm going to show you something about that a little later on, but just bear that in mind. And so in the third verse, Ahab king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat king of Judah, "Wilt thou go with me to Ramoth Gilead?" And he answered him, "I as thou," I crossed out the words "am" and "art" in my Bible, they're not there. "I as thou, I'm identifying myself with you, Ahab. You represent me." and my people as thy people. And we will be with thee in the war. Wrong war. Because it turned out to be an enormous tragedy for Jehoshaphat and for the army he had developed by a campaign of education. And then we have in the following verses, and we'll have to be quick as we proceed through these, that remarkable story of the way in which Jehoshaphat and Ahab, sitting in the gate of Samaria, found themselves surrounded by the 400 foolish prophets of Baal. We read in the fourth verse that Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, "Inquire, I pray thee, at the word of Yahweh today." And almost immediately, they've got a problem. Ahab doesn't serve Yahweh. He serves Baal. And here they are in the lights. Jehoshaphat has agreed to go with him. The contract has been signed. But they can't even agree about the name of their God. "Inquire, I pray thee, at the word of Yahweh today." And as Ahab coughs and splutters in verse 5, he gathers together the prophets, 400 men, and says to them, "Shall we go to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear?" But Jehoshaphat in verse 6 says, "Isn't there a prophet of Yahweh besides, that we might inquire of him?" You know, I want to show you something about what happens to men who were so determined, who had such an executive spirit to achieve objectives, as Jehoshaphat did. I want to show you what happens to them when they have got themselves mixed up in this sort of foolish alliance. They might have thought they were strong enough to handle it, but they weren't. And look at the sheepish way in verse 6 that Jehoshaphat replies. If he'd been back in Jerusalem and they'd brought out 400 idiots like this, prophets of Baal, you know what he would have said? Well, I wouldn't be able to say the words perhaps from this platform. He wouldn't have sworn, obviously, but he would have made it very pointed to them that they were a bunch of no-hopers who ought to be put to death. He wouldn't have tolerated it, but he tolerates it here. And have a look what he says in verse 7. The king of Israel replies to Jehoshaphat, "Yes, there is yet one man by whom we may inquire of Yahweh, but I hate him, for he never prophesied good to me, but always evil. He's always been in opposition to me. The same is Micaiah." His name means "who is like Yah." And that's why he's always different to Ahab. "Who is like Yah, the son of Imlah?" And Jehoshaphat said, and look at this fawning answer. Look at this sheepish approach. Jehoshaphat says, "Don't be like that." You know, he would have told Ahab where to jump off, wouldn't he? Had he been back in Jerusalem. But he wasn't in Jerusalem. Look what verse 9 says. "And the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat king of Judah sat either of them on his throne," which means the throne of David was there, "clothed in their robes, and they sat in an empty place at the entering in of the gate of Samaria." You know who built Samaria? Omri, the father of Ahab, built Samaria. And it was in that city that the statutes of Omri were kept, and now there was emanating the works of the house of Ahab. And the throne of David was sitting in an empty place. Get the point of that? It was sitting in an empty place because there was no knowledge of Yahweh there. And, brethren and sisters, the throne of David disappeared in an empty place. It's a tragic record. We go on. We can't read all the prophecy of Micaiah, but we shall read verses 15 and 16. "The king said to him," after Micaiah has already clashed with him, given him an ironical answer, The king says to him, how many times shall I adjure thee that thou say nothing but the truth to me in the name of Yahweh? They had fought before, these two, so Micaiah gives him the truth. Look at these words. Then he said, I did see all Israel, and he means by that Israel and Judah, because they were now locked together. I am as thou, and my people as your people. They were now all Israel, and they were scattered upon the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And Yahweh said, these have no master. Now there was the divine comment. These have no master. Of course, Micaiah is predicting the death of Ahab, which occurs in this chapter. But Jehoshaphat didn't die. He was still there. He was in fact at that war. We're going to see him dressed up in the king's robes. Wasn't he a master? He wasn't. He was gone as far as God was concerned. He had disappeared. By making an alliance with Ahab and locking himself together with Ahab, when Ahab was dead, there was no master. There was no shepherd. And so we read on at the end of the 16th verse. These have no master. Let them return, therefore, every man to his house in peace. I want you to make very careful note of that last phrase. Let them return, every man, to his house in peace. And have a look at verse 1 of chapter 19. And Jehoshaphat, and this is after the battle, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned to his house in peace. He was just one of the ordinary defeated soldiers who was like a sheep that had no shepherd. But wasn't he the great teacher of Judah? Was he not the great shepherd who went out and brought them to Yahweh? Was he not the man who sent forth his messengers, bearing the book of the law to teach in that land? Of course he was. Wasn't he a shepherd? Not as far as God was concerned. Wasn't he a master? Not as far as God was concerned. Why not, brothers and sisters? Because he had made an alliance with Ahab. What happened to his strength? What happened to his riches and reputation? They went down the drain. Because, brothers and sisters, no man is strong enough to do what Jehoshaphat attempted to do. Because God is not with it. And when God is not with it, it cannot succeed, whatever your strength may be. These, said Yahweh, have no master. Let them return, every man, to his own house in peace. What a prophecy that was. And so they went forth to battle. You might like to make a note that verse 26 and verse 27 also repeat that phrase, return in peace. We'll go to verse 28. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth Gilead. They went to the city of refuge. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and will go to the battle, but put thou on thy robes. In the Septuagint version, brothers and sisters and young people, it reads this way. Ahab says, disguise me and I will enter the battle, and do thou put on my robes. And that's what happened. The end of the verse says, so the king of Israel disguised himself, that is, as an ordinary soldier, and Jehoshaphat, brethren and sisters, put on the robes of King Ahab. I believe the Septuagint is right, because the context demands that it be so. Here was King Jehoshaphat, who had now become, by his compromise, King Ahab. He was actually wearing Ahab's clothes. And the Syrians mistook him for Ahab. So we read in verse 30, now the king of Syria had commanded the captains of the chariots that were with him, saying, fight ye not with small or great, save only with the King of Israel. He was only interested in one man. And verse 31 says, it came to pass that when the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat, that they said, it is the King of Israel. Because you see, they knew what sort of robes Ahab wore. Now why was it that Ben-Hadad said to his men, I'm only interested in one man. I want Ahab. But we haven't got time to go back to the 1st of Kings 20. But it's wise to put a little note in your margin. To 1st Kings 20 and verse 42. For there you will find a record at the end of a long chapter in which Yahweh gave Ahab victory over the Syrians on two or three occasions. And on the final occasion, Ahab took captive Ben-Hadad, king of Syria. You know what he did with him? Instead of putting him to death, which is what Yahweh wanted, he took him up in his own chariot and said, come with me, my brother. And Ben-Hadad, putting his arm around King Ahab, said, oh, you're a wonderful chap. I'll make streets for you in Damascus. And as soon as he could get off the chariot, he did, and he went for his life. And he got back to Damascus, and he began to scheme as to how he could put Ahab to death. And the prophet of Yahweh came out against Ahab and said, why didn't you kill him? God gave him into your hand. Why didn't you put him out of existence? And he was rebuked because of it. You know what that's teaching us, brothers and sisters and young people? The lesson is this. You let the flesh off the hook, and it will relentlessly pursue you until it kills you. And Ben-Hadad, when he came out to war again, was interested in one man alone. He wanted Ahab's neck. The flesh is relentless. You let it escape, and it will pursue you until you are finished. And when they came out and they saw Jehoshaphat dressed up in Ahab's robes, they surrounded him. They said, he's the king of Israel, verse 31, therefore they compassed about him to fight. The word compass there, kabad in Hebrew, means to revolve, or to surround, or border. It has the idea of being caught in a vortex of a whirlpool. And as they were around him, there's poor old King Jehoshaphat. Can you imagine the confusion of his mind? He can't understand what's happening. The war's supposed to be going on, but the Syrians are not interested in anybody else but him. And as they go round and round him, his head begins to go round with them, and they're revolving around him, until, brothers and sisters, we read at the end of that verse, that he cried out, he shrieked, and Yahweh helped him. And God, or Elohim, moved them to depart from him. Do you know what that word moved is in the Hebrew? It's that word suit, remember? Verse 2, persuaded. And Yahweh steps in to reverse the persuasion of Ahab and of Jezebel to save Jehoshaphat from the frying pan of his own making. And by the skin of his teeth he escapes destruction because he cried out to Yahweh. And he was allowed, like any other of the ordinary soldiers of that army, to go home. No master, no shepherd, in peace to his own home. You know, if ever we were being taught anything about what we, brothers and sisters, should be doing, we are being taught it in this chapter. We ought to be doing what Jehoshaphat did in the 17th chapter. Strengthening ourselves by rising above through a campaign of education and leaving the Ahabs to fight their own battles, because we cannot fight them successfully alongside of those with whom Yahweh cannot work, except when in the case of 1 Kings 20 it was in one last ditch effort
to try and bring Ahab to some sort of sense. But it failed. Now then, what happens? Well, what happened was that as Jehoshaphat licks his wounds, Ahab receives his death blow. For it came to pass, verse 32, that when the captains of the chariots perceived that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back again from pursuing him. And a certain man drew a bow at a venture and smote the king of Israel between the joints of the harness. Therefore he said to his chariot man, "Turn thine hand, get me out of here, for I am wounded." But, says verse 34, the battle increased that day. He couldn't get out and he died from a loss of blood. But in verse 33 we have some very interesting words here. For instance, when it says a certain man drew a bow at a venture, the word venture there is the Hebrew tome, T-O-M-E. And it's the singular for the Hebrew word thummim. Did you note that? It is the singular for the Hebrew word thummim, which is in the plural. The word for between the joints of the harness, in fact the word between the joints, as you'll see there from the margin, simply means the shoulder joints, and the word for harness has reference to the breastplate. Here we have just the ordinary armour of the soldier. It consisted of some sort of plate armour on the chest and shoulder joints to the armour on the arms, etc. That word for breastplate or harness, as it is there, is only used twice in the Old Testament. The other occurrence is in Isaiah 59 verse 17, where it is in fact rendered breastplate. So it's not talking about the breastplate of the high priest, brethren and sisters, but there are echoes, are there not, of the high priest of Israel. But what we have here is God's judgment upon the wickedness of Ahab to bring him to a very sticky end. He died soaking in his own blood. And what happened? You can capture the scene in your mind. In the confusion of the battle, one of the Syrians in the back lines who hadn't done much that day thought to himself, "Well, I've got to do something about this war." So he drew out an arrow, looking the wrong way, and he drew a bow at a venture, bang, and sat down again and started to drink his coffee. But the hand of the Elohim was upon that arrow, guiding it to a destination. And as Ahab fought the battle in the garments of the ordinary soldier, that arrow, the thummim of Yahweh, struck him behind the breastplate. And in Exodus chapter 28 and verse 30, we read that Aaron the high priest would bear upon his heart behind the breastplate the Urim and the Thummim. And they were at a city of refuge, Ramoth Gilead. And Ahab never came home. I think we can see what that record is getting at. And there he died, standing up in his chariot, locked in battle, from a loss of blood, because he had shed the blood of Naboth the Jezreelite, and had been told that dogs would lick his blood. And then the 19th chapter, and we've run out of time this evening, goes on to speak about the rebuke that Yahweh brought to King Jehoshaphat. And he accepted it. Unlike Asa his father, who didn't, this man did. Jehu, verse 2, the son of Hanani, Jehu means Yah is he, a divine representative, son of Hanai, which means gracious, Yahweh being gracious to him, as he had been to his father through Hanani the prophet, came to meet him, and said to King Jehoshaphat, "Shouldest thou help the ungodly, and love them that hate Yahweh?" The word love there is the Hebrew word Ahab, and you spell it exactly the same as the main Ahab. "Should you, Ahab, be Ahab's Jehoshaphat? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before Yahweh. Nevertheless, there are good things found in thee, in that thou hast taken away the graves out of the land, and hast prepared or fixed thine heart to pursue God." And, note, the result of this rebuke, "and Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem." He took the throne of David out of the void place in Samaria and took it back to Jerusalem where it belonged. And the record then says that he went out again through all the people, from Beersheba to Mount Ephraim and brought them back unto Yahweh God of their fathers. Brought them back where? He brought them back to where they belonged, to Jerusalem. And then he goes about the task of setting up judges in that land and instructs them as to what they were to do. They were to be Jehoshaphat's, Yahweh's judges. And encourages them at the end of verse 11 by saying, deal courageously and Yahweh shall be with the good. So he makes good, brothers and sisters, as much as he can of the disaster that had occurred to him. His army was dispersed. He was no longer there. Many had died in the battle of Ramoth Gilead. His reforms had been shaken. But he tries to make it good. Until 2 years later, he decides to make another alliance. You know, over the page in chapter 20, we read at verse 35, and after this did Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, join himself with Ahaziah, king of Israel, the son of Ahab, who did very wickedly. And he joined himself with him to make ships to go to Tarshish, and they made the ships in Ezion Geber, or Elath. When Eliezer, the son of Dodavar of Marishah, prophesied against Jehoshaphat, saying, because thou hast joined thyself with Ahaziah, Yahweh hath broken thy works. And the ships were broken, for they couldn't go to Tarshish. Ahaziah tried to renew that, to rebuild the ships. He wanted to make the alliance again. But Jehoshaphat said, no, I'm sorry. Why did that man make the same mistake again? Well, I suppose he thought Ahab was dead. Why not perhaps go into some sort of trading venture, money-making venture? After all, we might be able to use the money for some benefit to the truth. But it was brought to ruin. Brothers and sisters, you'd think, wouldn't you, that Jehoshaphat would never make the same mistake again. Have a look at 2 Kings 3. Why did he do this? Well, I believe that he did it because he had in his house a woman who was just as determined to teach and seduce the servants of Yahweh as was Jezebel his mother, and her name was Athaliah, and she was irresistible. She swamped Jehoram. He was a nonentity. And she applied her arts to Jehoshaphat. And the pressure she brought to bear on Jehoshaphat caused him to make two more alliances, both of which were disasters. So in 2 Kings chapter 3, we read in verse 1 that Jehoram the son of Ahab began to reign over Israel and Samaria the 18th year of Jehoshaphat king of Judah, and reigned 12 years. And he wrought evil in the sight of Yahweh, but not like his father and like his mother, for he put away the image of Baal that his father had made. He made concessions. You see, he went part of the way. He went back to the worship of Jeroboam. Verse 3 tells us that. Nevertheless, he cleaved unto the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. He departed not therefrom. And so Jehoshaphat, as he sat in his palace in Jerusalem, with this pressure coming from his own family to do something about Israel, when he saw they made some concessions and they'd come part of the way, he thought, well, that's good enough for me. And out he goes to fight with them again. It was a disaster. You know what happened, brothers and sisters? Well, what happened was this. I haven't got time to go to the chapters tonight. Jehoshaphat died. As soon as he was dead and before his body was cold, Athaliah had arranged for the murder of all his sons except the one she was married to. He lost his entire family. 8 years later, Yahweh killed Jehoram, his eldest son, because of his great wickedness. And as soon as he was dead, Athaliah put her son, Ahaziah, on the throne. And when he was killed by Jehu, she rose up and she slaughtered all the royal seed of the house of David, and there was only one male child of the house of David left and he was 6 months old. And he was saved by the skin of his teeth. The covenants made to David were brought, as I said at the start, to within a hair's breadth of total ruin. Of course Yahweh couldn't allow that, because he'd made a promise to David. But that, brothers and sisters, is how far it went. Right down to the breath of 1 6-month-old boy. It was a fatal alliance, wasn't it? And there were enormously tragic consequences. What a terrible story that is. How different it could have been. Let us, brothers and sisters, learn the lesson of Jehoshaphat's life. And let us, like him, soar high in the things of the truth by turning our minds to the word of Yahweh, carrying it with us, that we might be taught and teach others that we must manifest our God in mercy and truth in proper balance, that there might be separation from those things that would lead to disaster. And let us take to heart the words of King Jehoshaphat himself. Brethren, he said to those whom he sent forth, deal courageously, and Yahweh will be with the good.